One of the best ways you can do it is simply by becoming a sustainer, pledging $10 or more each month. In that way, you help to protect this independent radio station. And sign up today.
You can join KPFK's sustainer program by logging on to kpfk.org.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse collective of feminists. And every week we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. Because we want you to know a little bit more about Feminist Magazine, who we are and how we do it, and why you'll want to support feminist radio on the air on KPFK every week. And I'm Lynn Harris-Ballin, your host today, and this is what feminism can sound like. And this week, it's the birthday celebration of the great poet and writer Audre Lorde. And we're bringing you an excerpt from the Pacifica Radio Archives with Audre Lorde from 1980 to celebrate her birthday and also celebrate Black History Month.
You know, one of the terrible things, I think, about the kind of consumption or the kind of consumptive life or consumptive society that we live in is that one of the first things it consumes is our history. And so over and over again, those things that would allow us to make coalitions, to make connections between the things that have happened to us, the things that have happened to our mothers, to our fathers, to people before us, are lost. And as I say elsewhere, we're constantly being put in the position of having to reinvent the wheel.
On December 12, 1980, prize-winning poet and writer Audre Lorde gave a reading of her poetry and her prose. The reading was a benefit for the Women's Experimental Theater, and it was a gala and well-attended event. Audre Lorde talked and read from her poetry and from her inspiring new book, Cancer Journal. Claire Koss, who introduced Audre Lorde.
To name all of Audre Lorde's accomplishments would take the entire evening, and also the honors that she's received. But my favorite introduction is Audre's own words in a recent essay where she says, "I am Black, lesbian, feminist, poet, mother of a daughter and son, and member of an interracial couple." She essentially goes on to say, "How many things can our society hate me for?" Audre lives on the front lines. She lives openly and charts forbidden and unknown terrains, and she empowers us with her courage. Her most recent battle with breast cancer, the terror, the pain, and the daily triumph, has become an impassioned and valued resource for women in the cancer journals just published by Spinsters, Inc. Audre Lorde is an Amazon warrior who challenges each one of us by her choice to break silences, to survive, and to celebrate life. Audre Lorde.
I would like to open the reading with a poem that I feel is very timely, or that occurred to me, because it seems to say, for me, something that I need to be reminded of, and something that I think that most of us do, particularly in this time when I think we all feel so much under siege for one reason or the other. And the title of this poem is A Song for Many Movements. Nobody wants to die on the way, caught between ghosts of whiteness and the real water. None of us wanted to leave our bones on the way to salvation. Three planets to the left a century of light years ago. Our spices were separate and particular, but our skins sing in complementary keys. At a quarter to eight, mean time, We were telling the same stories over and over and over. But broken-down gods survive in the crevasses and mud pots of every beleaguered city, where it is obvious there are too many bodies to cast to the ovens or gallows, and our uses have become more important than our silence. After the fall, too many empty cases of blood to bury or burn, and there will be nobody left to listen. And our labor has become more important than our silence. Our labor is more important than our silence. I'd like to read some excerpts now from the Cancer Journals, which is a collection of prose. Let me tell you a little bit about how it came to be written. How it came to be written was, I have breast cancer, and after my mastectomy, I decided that while I was going through it and before I was making my decision, I looked for words, for other women's words that would give me a sense, not of what to do, but of another woman's experience. And I could not find them. I found books written by women that dealt with certain aspects, but not from the core. And certainly not any words from feminists, certainly no words from black feminists, and certainly no words from black lesbians. And I decided that it was about time, right? Some of it got aired. And also because it helped me. The book is really a collection. There are three essays and an introduction. And I would like to read a piece from the introduction and some from the last essay. Each woman responds to the crisis that breast cancer brings to her life out of a whole pattern, which is the design of who she is and how her life has been lived. The weave of her everyday existence is the training ground for how she handles crisis. I am a post-mastectomy woman who believes our feelings need voice in order to be recognized, respected, and of use. I do not wish my anger and pain and fear about cancer to fossilize into yet another silence, nor to rob me of whatever strength can lie at the core of this experience, openly acknowledged and examined. For other women of all ages, colors, and sexual identities who recognize that imposed silence about any area of our lives is a tool for separation and powerlessness, and for myself, I have tried to voice some of my feelings and thoughts about the travesty of prosthesis, the pain of amputation, the function of cancer in a profit economy, my confrontation with mortality, the strength of women loving, and the power and rewards of self-conscious living. Breast cancer and mastectomy are not unique experiences. They are ones shared by thousands of American women. Each of these women has a particular voice to be raised in what must become a female outcry against all preventable cancers, as well as against the secret fears that allow those cancers to flourish. May these words serve as encouragement for other women to speak and to act out of our experiences with cancer and with other threats of death. For silence has never bought us anything of worth. Most of all, may these words underline the possibilities of self-healing and the richness of living for all women. Now, there is a commonality of isolation and painful reassessment that is shared by all women with breast cancer, whether this commonality is recognized or not. It is not my intention to judge the woman who has chosen the path of prosthesis. Do you all know what I'm speaking of when I speak of prosthesis? Do you know what a prosthesis is? No. Prosthesis is a false breast. It's a falsie. And this is given to women right after breast cancer is supposed to wear it and pretend that nothing has ever happened, right? Supposed to be that we are supposedly, what we're told is that we are as good as before. And this is absolutely accepted. Probably most women who've had mastectomies wear these things. It is not my intention to judge the woman who has chosen the path of prosthesis, of silence and invisibility. The woman who wishes to be, quote, the same as before. She has survived on another kind of courage, and she is not alone. Each of us struggles daily with the pressures of conformity, the loneliness of difference from which those choices seem to offer escape. I only know that these choices do not work for me, nor for other women who, not without fear, have survived cancer by scrutinizing its meaning within our lives and by attempting to integrate that crisis into useful strengths for change. I have learned a great deal in the 18 months since my mastectomy. My visions of a future I can create have been honed by the lessons of my limitations. Now I wish to give form with honesty and precision to the pain, faith, labor, and loving which this period of my life has translated into strength for me. Sometimes fear stalks me like another malignancy, sapping energy and power and attention from my work. A cold becomes sinister, a cough, lung cancer, a bruise, leukemia. But those fears I have found are most powerful when I do not give them voice, because close upon their heels comes a fury that I cannot shake them. I am learning to live beyond fear by living through it, and in the process, trying to learn to turn fury at my own limitations into a more creative energy. I realize that if I wait until I am no longer afraid to act, write, speak, be, then I'll be sending little messages on a Ouija board, cryptic complaints from the other side. When I dare to be powerful, to use my strength in the service of vision, then it becomes less important whether or not I am unafraid. Because as women, we were all raised to fear. If I cannot banish fear completely, I can learn to count with it less. For then fear becomes not a tyrant against which I waste energy fighting, but a companion, not particularly desirable, but one whose knowledge can be useful. I write so much here about fear because in shaping this introduction to the cancer journals, I found fear laid across my hands like a steel bar. When I tried to examine the past 18 months, some of what I touched was molten despair and waves of mourning for my lost breast, for time, for the luxury of false power. Not only were these emotions difficult and painful to relive, but they were entwined with a terror that if I opened myself again to scrutiny, then I might also be opening myself to disease. But I had to remind myself that I had lived through it all already. I had known the pain, and I had survived. It only remained now for me to give it voice, to share it for use, that the pain not be wasted. Living a self-conscious life under the pressure of time, I work with the consciousness of death at my shoulder, not constantly, but often enough to leave a mark upon all of my life's decisions. And it does not matter whether this death comes next week, or 30 years from now, this consciousness gives my life another breath. It helps shape the words I speak, the ways I love, my politic of action, the strength of my vision, my purpose, and the depth of my appreciation for living. I would lie if I did not speak of loss. Any amputation is a physical and psychic reality that must be integrated into a sense of self. The absence of my breast is a recurrent sadness, but it is not one that dominates my life. I miss it, sometimes piercingly. When other one-breasted women hide behind the mask of prosthesis, I find little support in the broader female environment for my rejection of what feels like a cosmetic sham. But I believe that socially sanctioned prosthesis is merely another way of keeping women with breast cancer silent and separate from each other. For instance, what would happen if an army of one-breasted women descended upon Congress and demanded that the use of carcinogenic fat-stored hormones in beef feed be outlawed? You get that picture? I have found that battling despair does not mean closing my eyes to the enormity of the tasks of effecting change. Nor does it mean ignoring the strength and the barbarity of the forces which are aligned against us. It means, however, teaching, surviving, and fighting with the most important resource I have, myself. And it means taking joy in that battle. It means, for me, recognizing the enemy outside and the enemy within, and knowing that my work is part of a continuum of women's work, of reclaiming this earth and our power, and knowing that this work did not begin with my birth, nor will it end with my death. It means knowing within that continuum my life and my love and my work has particular power and meaning relative to others. It also means trout fishing on the Manisqua River at dawn and tasting the green silence and knowing that this beauty, too, is mine forever.
Audre Lorde talked and read from her poetry and from her inspiring new book, Cancer Journal.
I'm pleased and privileged to be introducing Audre Lorde to this benefit reading for the Women's Experimental Theater tonight. I remember about 5 years ago, the first time you came to a performance of Daughters, after which we invited the audience to stay and form a circle to name their matrilineage together. You said, "I am Audre, daughter of Linda, daughter of Ma Liz, daughter of a woman who lived on Knowles Hill, daughter of Sebelisa, the mother of us all." Audre had been to visit Dahomey with her lover and son and daughter, and was immersed in her research on African mythologies and goddesses, making accessible in her poems such names and concepts as Mawalisa, the sky goddess god, Yemanja, the mother of Orisha, and goddess of oceans, Sebelisa, the mother of us all, and many others. In The Black Unicorn, these gods and goddesses of Dahomey and Nigeria cross paths with and connect with Staten Island and 125th Street, find refuge in poems of loving, and tear through violent images of black children being shot down and murdered by white policemen.
You can support KPFK and our show today, Feminist Magazine. Just go to the kpfk.org website and click the donate button. It's easy. If you do that right now, your conscience is clear. You have done it for this fund drive, and then you can go back to listening to the rest of the show. And that is just one example of the kind of story we love to highlight. Feminist Magazine brings you voices like that, and also feminist artists and creatives, plus, of course, local activists telling you ways that you can take action, you know, grassroots action, and make a difference yourself. That is what we actually mean when we say at the top of our show every week that we're bringing you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. And you can support us to keep us doing that right now. You can just go to the kpfk.org website and click the donate button. You can give $10, $25, $50, $100, or become a sustaining member. We want to be a sustainable radio station. And so if you just give us your credit card, we do a monthly payment. You choose how much. And then it's a sustainable way to keep bringing you these stories. Site is kpfk.org, and there's a donate button. You are listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK 90.7 FM and kpfk.org.
That's what is good about KPFK. You do get it that it's the people, not the manufacturers that are selling us all the cheap soap and toothpaste and general unhealthy junk. But it's really information that is quite usable. I'm Joyce Clark from Bellingham, Washington. I listen to KPFK as much as I possibly can, and I do support it.
KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and if you're in Bellingham or anywhere else in the world, www.kpfk.org.
We bring you The Healing Project, a multimedia installation that features personal stories from those who are incarcerated and highlights the deep trauma that imprisonment has had on their lives and their loved ones. When you walk into The Healing Project at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts in San Francisco, you see a piano centered in the middle of a huge space, connected to three smaller rooms. There's sound coming from every direction. People's voices talking about their life experiences with prisons. There's an altar against one wall, draped with prayer beads, white candles, dried flowers, and bottles of alcohol. Above it is a mural of a person crowned with flowers, their faces in a silhouette, but somehow feels like you can look into their eyes.
Welcome to The Healing Project. This is basically just the title wall. Obviously, for like any type of exhibition you have, the title wall, which is like an introduction context for people to understand what they're going to experience. And so we wanted to try to write it like from a personal perspective. So all this language here is just basically from my artist statement of like trying to explain why I tried to create the project and what's inside of it. Obviously, the heart of the project is in the interviews, some of which you'll hear, that we did across the country with folks who have experience structural violence from a series of different contexts, talking to them about what they went through, but also about the healing practices. And it's like a combination, like sound, visuality, language. We're trying to kind of basically cover all the bases. So these right here at the beginning, these are tapes that have short interviews on them from different folks that are incarcerated.
That's some more interviews. The Bay Area raised composer, pianist, singer, and activist. He has spent the past 8 years exploring structures of systemic racism, specifically how many families navigate the daily realities of state violence and the systems of detention and incarceration in the United States. He comes from a family with a long history of social and racial justice activism. His father, Howard Penderhughes, was an organizer in the anti-apartheid movement as a student at UC Berkeley. He later went on to work with violence prevention organizations and is an active member of the Brotherhood of Elders Network. His mother, Raquel Penderhughes, is also an activist. Fighting for environmental and racial justice, supporting solidarity movements in Latin America, and creating programs to support incarcerated youth and adults while also fighting to abolish the prison industrial complex. Penderhughes follows in his parents' footsteps. He wants the Healing Project to lift up the voices of those who have been locked up and silenced, to not only show the world that this flawed system should be abolished, but to also show support for people who've experienced structural violence.
Telling the truths about the violences of the current system and the true need to basically eradicate it, not to reform it, and being like super honest about how it affects people. And then on the other side, actually showing what type of other world is possible and what people actually need in their day-to-day if they're going to actually be the healthiest versions of themselves. The piece that I always talk about first or think about first is a piece that is narrated and spoken by my brother Keith Lamar, who's incarcerated in Ohio on death row. And it's called Sweet, and it's basically like a piece where he discusses his experience, not just being incarcerated, but even growing up previous to that as a very young person, because he was incarcerated very young. But basically the thesis of it is he's talking about the thing that he's the most proud of throughout his whole time of his life is that he's maintained and held on to his sweetness, because every level from his childhood and growing up in this country to, obviously being incarcerated, everything is designed to rob him of that sweetness and to kind of make him unfeeling, make him like hard and all this stuff. And he's just like, I always hold on to that sweet part of myself. And then he talks about also the people around him that help him maintain that and support that part of him. And I love that because, obviously, number one, I really believe in that so much, and that we all need to hold on to that and be able to hold on to that. But also because I think it directly contradicts the image that one wants to paint of somebody on death row.
Penderhughes walks me to a room with words on the wall that read, "They chew you up, swallow you." Audio was playing of a man named Keith Lamar describing how he holds on to his humanity despite being incarcerated.
I mean, one of the things that I'm surprised about, and my friends tell me this, people who that really know me, it's kind of still kind of surprising to me. I'm sweet, man. I mean, I love being sweet to my friends, and when I was younger, when I was growing up, that wasn't cool to be sweet. I remember the little sweet little boy I was. And by sweet, I mean I just like to make connection with people. I like that tenderness. It's the human thing. To connect with people on. But this situation, when we talk about the criminal justice system, really what it is a digestive system. A digestive tract. They chew you up with that education.
This call is originating from an Ohio correctional facility and may be recorded and monitored.
They chew you up with that education, swallow you, and you go in the stomach, the large, small intestines, and then you come out as a piece of meat. So one of the things I've been kind of most amazed about myself that I've been able to hold on to my sweetness, my sense of, that's one of the things I most like about myself. But the only people that are really close to me that kind of know, because you have to have the opportunity to, I'm sweet to myself as well. I'm good to myself. Even after all I've been through, and that's one of the things that I want people to know, that even in even if your worst fears come true, nothing, but death itself can rob you of who you really are. Nothing. I can be myself. God gave me an understanding. One of my close friends told me a long time ago, he said, for money, life can be had no matter where you are. You can still laugh in prison. You can still cry in prison. You can still, be who you are, where you are. Yeah. That's what I think I'm most proud about. And everything that I've accomplished, man, is that I've been able to hold on to that, sense of sweetness in myself. Yeah.
Keith Lamar was sentenced to prison at the age of 19 for murder. He has spent over 30 years in prison, most of it in solitary confinement. The Healing Project forces us to acknowledge the deep problems in America's so-called system of corrections and rehabilitation. Penderhughes exposes the system's focus on forced servitude, imprisonment and punishment, and its failure to consider the futures of those re-entering society and the impacts on their families and communities.
A prison is like, it's like an embassy. That's the only way I can think of it. It's like they don't have to follow the rules of the governing land. They just have their own, policies, and there's no one there to say it's not okay.
I think that, so much of
the left is prison conditioning, right? Conditioning to see oneself as inferior, conditioning to break people, conditioning to try to have people be less of themselves, right? And I'm very intentional and very habitual about this for myself, is that I refuse to walk with my head down. I refuse not to look somebody in the eye. and when I see somebody do that, you know, I definitely point it out to them, like, not heads up.
You know, so it's kind of like, you know, there's nothing good that's going to come out of this situation except for me leaving this place. Titles like inmate, convict, ex-felon, they're demeaning titles. They're put in place to diminish self-respect and dignity, and to demean you and your character and to break your spirit. And I believe this is all connected with the billion-dollar industrial prison complex.
How do we capture? They have conferences where they get together and they think really hard about how to make a better cage. And then they sell their products to them and they implement it on us. Caging.
Thank you for using TTL.
The Healing Project is a haunting tapestry of instrumentation and stories about the cruel nature of prison. Each interviewee offers truth and vulnerability about their experiences in hopes of expressing their pain and bringing attention to the inhumane realities of prison. The Healing Project shows the deep trauma that the prison system causes for families and the long journey of healing that must take place. Walking through the exhibition, I enter a dark grayish room with images of men and women being projected off the wall, recorded voices of people talking about the challenges that come after incarceration.
This is why I need to try to get my record expunged, man, because I'm always face these barriers, you know, especially if I'm trying to get some property, I'm trying to do something like that. I'm always facing barriers, you know, so, you know, I still feel that pain, you know, of being disenfranchised, man, being civilly dead.
No one wants to give you a home. No one wants to give you a place to stay because they think or feel you're going to be a problem just because you've been to jail and prison. You're going to have the wrong people. You're going to have too much coming in or out. You know, these are all the assumptions that they make up. Yeah, about people that's been in prison, when really all we want to do is get a place to stay, get some stability, and get on with our lives. But it's hard to, and since I know what that mentality and mindset is, it's hard to
talk to somebody
about these resources that you have when it's basically you selling pipe dreams when all they want is a place to stay. And a place to stay here right now is hard for anybody. 6 months to a year to find permanent housing. So what are they supposed to do in between that time? Do you think that they care about doing the right things when they just trying to live to survive? Nobody wants to take those penitentiary chances out there day to day. But sometimes that's what people are forced with, and especially if you're a mother with children.
Nobody wants to take those penitentiary chances.
Now I'm in a blue-lit room. I can hear interviewees talking about the psychological warfare of prison and the trauma they experienced.
It's basically like a mixtape. So, like, I took all the interviews, cut them up, brought them to different producers, and then I basically, like, made a few different pieces with each of the producers. So there's, it's like, each of the pieces are about 5 minutes, 3 to 5 minutes, and they're on loop. So it's basically like if you stay for however long you stay, you're getting that amount. But if you were to come in at a different time, you might hear something totally different, you know.
Civilized people don't live like this. This is the way animals live. This is animals. I'm not an animal.
A prison is like, it's like an embassy. That's the only way I can think of it. It's like they don't have to follow the rules of the governing land. You know what I'm saying? They just have their own, policies, and there's no one there to say it's not okay. So you can buck against the system, but they've got it in place. I mean, it's literally just like slavery.
you can run. If we catch your ass, this was gonna happen. So they let you see the folks who kick up against, you know what I'm saying, the system, and they parade them around, handcuffed, new dummy box, little spit mask on, just, whew. It's psychological warfare. And this bottom line is what it is. It's psychological warfare. And it has broken many people.
Sitting in the blue room, feeling the vibration of the woofers strategically planted underneath the bench, you cannot escape the raw and painful stories of people who could be your brother, your student, your neighbor, your friend, or even you.
If a person is coming in here that's 15, they have to hear that they have a resonance with.
Yeah.
But then also we have strings. We have, like, if a person comes in that's 60, it's going to be something for them too. All original production music from, like, me and, like, 20 other cats, like, all around New York. And then we mixed it specifically for surround sound for the space. So there's different parts of it coming out of every speaker.
Right. I saw it in the mic. I said, okay, I know.
Maximum impact.
Yeah,
maximum impact. So I try not to think about it. So there's a lot of ugly things in my heart. I just hope to the Lord I don't. You feel me? So there's some things that I don't want to admit. So I try not to think about it. There's a lot of ugly things in my heart. I just hope to the Lord.
You can support KPFK and our show today. Just go to the kpfk.org website and just click the donate button. It's that easy. And that was the kind of story we love to highlight. Not just stories of what's going wrong. We like to bring you stories of activists telling you how they're standing up to injustice, and feminist artists and creatives who are making films and writing books about ways to make change in the world, different ways to see the world. Plus, of course, local activists telling you ways that you can take action and make a difference yourself. So that's what we actually mean when we say at the top of the show every week that we're bringing you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist, but also engage. And you can support us to keep doing that right now. You just go to kpfk.org, the website, and you click the donate button. And this is Feminist Magazine on KPFK 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. And I'm your host today, Lynn Harris-Ballin. And we're proud to be on KPFK, along with a whole other host of varied voices from the community, but also varied perspectives, perspectives that you're not going to hear anywhere else on the radio dial, not in any of the kind of canned and already digested versions of news that you'll get anywhere else. But right here on KPFK, we're bringing you stories from our activism, from our lives, and from folks that we're excited to share with you. You can support KPFK and our show today. Just go to the kpfk.org website and just click the donate button. It's that easy.
Goodman, host of Democracy Now! In-depth news coverage is becoming a rare commodity in today's media landscape. There's a straightforward reason. It's no longer profitable for commercial media. Serious journalism is expensive. It takes time to prepare. It requires a large and talented team of researchers, reporters, editors, and producers. That's why listener-supported news and information on KPFK is more important than ever. We continue to bring you comprehensive coverage from skilled, dedicated journalists because you continue to support the work we do here all year round. Please continue to support KPFK, all the vital work that's done at this Pacifica station. Call 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-KPFK and join the KPFK Sustainer Circle, or you can give at kpfk.org.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. I'm your host today, Lynn Harris-Ballin.
We bring you The Healing Project, a multimedia installation that features personal stories from those who are incarcerated and highlights the deep trauma that imprisonment has had on their lives and their loved ones. Many people who enter the carceral system bring a series of traumatic experiences with them, including a lifetime of dealing with micro and macro level racism and oppression. Incarceration only adds to the trauma, which is oftentimes generational.
I've been into every prison in California and out behind my father. Like, I kind of grew up in the prisons, like where the prison guards kind of knew me and my mom. My dad wrote me letters since I was born, and he would always open the letter with the same phrase. You know, and I never wrote back because I was a kid. So I just expected my dad to write these letters, and he always did. He always remembered my birthday. He always remembered any dates that were important. He was good with dates. So he would write and say, oh yeah, you did this today. That's the relationship I had with him. And just all in my head, I had this fantasy about what I wanted him to be to me. And he just never could. You know, I seen my dad 10 months clean before he died. And I hurried up and went and took photographs. You know, he wasn't there for me or my sister when we were born, but he got to see Aaron born with me. You know, he got to see my son.
These transparent conversations have similar heartbreaking themes. Families torn apart and lost time. One part of the project is made up of over 100 powerful testimonies and an LP titled Grief, created by those who've been locked up. Pender Hughes has put these interviews together with songs. I sat with him to talk more about the messages in the music. He told me about one song in particular that best describes the project, titled Process.
I would say probably Process. You know, I would say that song definitely builds it, because I think that that song represents this idea that, you know, the key to moving through all of this in real time is understanding that we're not going to get through it tomorrow. It's not going to get better tomorrow. That's just the reality. So in that context, we do the best we can, and we recalibrate our expectations of what healing looks like, that it is not like a competitive triumph over one's demons or whatever one's going through. It's trying every day to make it a little bit better. And it's trying every day to extend grace to yourself in the way that you would to a person that you love, you know. And I think that that's a very important part for those that are going through those things. And that is, at the end of the day, what the project is made for. I want everyone to experience it, but the project is made for those that's going through the things.
So there's some things that I don't want. So I try not to think about it. There's a lot of ugly things in my heart. I just hope to the Lord I don't slip. I wonder what it's like to let it out. That part of me that I'm so afraid of. It holds on me and tosses me about. Doesn't seem to be something I get away. Tell me, how do you name those well-kept secrets that you never say out loud? And why does the body see these demons but keep me from calling out? I guess I'll just say it's a process, one day at a time.
Penderhughes highlights the harsh realities of the prison system, the traumatic experiences it causes for entire families, and the difficult long road to healing. He knows that the songs in the Healing Project are intense. He's pushing his audience to connect with those who are unseen and feel their undeniable pain and sorrow.
So there's a whole entire world that I've created in my mind.
The Healing Project is asking, how do we survive America? What does it mean to maintain one's humanity while dealing with the trauma of relentless systemic racism?
I don't really believe that true healing can exist in this type of capitalist society, because the whole society is built on exploitation. So it does not exist without exploitation. There's no way for it to exist. And that's another function of the prison, is that the prison is where we put all the people that would show us how much society has failed. You know, it's like, you don't want to look at how this capitalist system has created a problem with so many people being unhoused, or has created a problem with so many people losing their mortgage, or so many people, you know, not being able to have a job. It's like, y'all did this, but you don't want to look at it. So then you're going to take everybody and put them and lock them up, you know?
Penderhughes believes that it's possible to support alternatives to our draconian prison system, while also recognizing that people are complicated.
I definitely try to be very conscious of saying this project is not a project about innocence. Like, a lot of the people that are a part of the project have done different things, you know, but they're also some of the kindest, most brilliant, most loving individuals I've ever met. And when you get deep into them dealing with and talking about why those things happen and where they are now, number one, they're actually evidence of what a real process of accountability can look like, because they've actually moved through these processes in a way that few of us have, and definitely not because the prison did that for them, but because they did it themselves in spite of their conditions.
In the Healing Project, Penderhughes shines a light on the fact that true rehabilitation and healing cannot happen within systems built to enforce oppression and structural racism. He puts faces, voices, and humanity to people behind bars. He wants to see systemic change and stop the cycles of increased trauma and harm. His vision for the future is filled with hope for stronger organizing efforts to dismantle the prison industrial complex. He puts this energy into his music.
Hope, I wrote, I think that was the last song I wrote for the record, and it was something I wanted to represent of, like, I often get a, you know, I often get response from people of like, oh man, your work is like so dark, it's so like heavy and whatever, and I'm like, yeah, well, that's what I'm thinking about. But so I kind of titled it that, like, as a kind of a cheeky thing, like, hey, well, here you go. But, you know, obviously it's not like a purely happy-go-lucky song, but to me it does represent what hope means to me, which, as I said, hope is a discipline. And I think for me it represents this era of, you know, for some people the things that are going on is not a reality we can check in and out of. But I think for a lot of other folks, you know, a lot of white folks, a lot of rich folks, a lot of different people, you know, you can check in and out of the fight, depending on when it's comfortable for you to be there and how you feel about, you know, how guilty are you today? That's going to make determine whether you would participate or not. And so I wanted to do a song that challenged that and said, like, you know, you can't just, if you really want to represent hope, you can't just say, oh, hope means I just gonna hope it gets better. No, you have to participate, and you have to realize that it's not gonna just go away because you wish it away. It's only gonna go away if we organize.
You told me the war is over, while everything's for sale, it's all in a good performance. Yes, you pretend to care, hide the weapons. It's all for the crowd, you wanna believe so badly that everything was safe. Don't nobody lose a fortune, it works for you. It's awfully loud in here, 'cause Jesse still owes his rent now, and Bree is working for 500 cents, and C is still calling collect now. Can't believe in what you say when I see this. Can't believe of the preachers when your whole existence is illegal, while we wash up all the blood of the people. Wash up all the blood, and I can't hear it all.
One of the most powerful things about the Healing Project is the community of creators that have created it with me. It's almost 100 different people, between folks who are narrators who have shared their stories, visual creators, artwork, music, and this is very much of a collective project. And the best part of it, I think, is that hopefully when people step into the space, whether it's digitally, whether it's physically, they will feel that collective notion. They'll feel that thing of, this is a group of folks that have come together to try to really almost create an artistic rendition of them being around a dinner table talking to each other about these things, but from all around the country. And my hope is that when people will step into it, they will feel like they need to give themselves into that. You know, I don't want them to think, oh, I'm going to take something away. I want them to give themselves to it, you know. So that's my hope for how people will approach it. And I would say the other secondary one would just be, I think the other powerful thing about it is the practical tools that people can get away from it. If they're really listening to the pieces in the sound room, I really believe that people will be able to have physical, practical tools that they can take away for when they go through grieving process, when they're dealing with something that's really hard, when they've experienced, you know, some type of trauma and they're trying to heal from it. They'll have practical things they can do.
This project functions as an abolitionist narrative. It calls for an end to the current prison system. It urges us to create new ways of addressing conflict and processes that are more humane. In February of 2023, Samora Pennahues was awarded a $1 million grant from the Mellon Foundation in further support of the Healing Project. Funding will go towards the expansion of artworks in the Healing Project exhibition, the creation of a book, free community programs, and the creation of new content. The grant also provides the initial funding for the Healing Project Transformative Impact Fund, which will offer seed money and mentorship for selected interviewees who are currently or formerly incarcerated to work on their own special projects. All work is based on the premise that the deepest healing strategies come directly from those who have been traumatized and oppressed. I've been your host, Anita Johnson.
I just hope to the Lord I don't. I just hope to the Lord I don't slip. You feel me? Said there's some things that I don't want to admit, so I try not to think about it. There's a lot of ugly things in my heart. I just hope to the Lord I don't. I wonder what it's like to let it out. that part of me that I'm so afraid of.
You can support KPFK and our show today. You go to the kpfk.org website. It's really easy. You just click the donate button, walk through a couple of steps, and there you are. You can choose to make a donation of $25, $50, or you might want to be a subscribing supporter, and that would be great. We would love you to do that. A big part of what we do here on Feminist Magazine is that we're a collective of diverse voices and contributors, and that means we bring a bunch of different viewpoints to our listeners, all kinds of perspectives and stories and guests every week. And we're teaching radio skills like interviewing, engineering, and editing to young college students and to grassroots feminists from different communities across the city. But most of all, we give our time and sweat to Feminist Magazine because we believe in radio as a tool for activism and solidarity building. I'm an activist in other parts of the community. All of the contributors here are involved in many different ways. And all through the lockdown and the pandemic, we just kept it going remotely for you. A lot of the folks here at KPFK who bring you shows are actively involved in the communities that they're bringing you stories about, so that you know what we're bringing you is authentic, it's real, and we're always looking for different angles to stories to bring you things that you haven't heard about in the mainstream media. KPFK, as you know, is people-powered radio. It's funded by people like you. And in these times, this is when we need you to step up and give back to the station that you're listening to and support KPFK. So show us a little love, won't you? You go to the kpfk.org website. It's really easy. You just click the donate button, walk through a couple of steps, and there you are. And we are going to be wrapping up another edition of Feminist Magazine. Thank you to all of our guests and our contributors to today. And here is your chance to support KPFK in this hour. This is your last chance to support KPFK in this feminist hour on KPFK. If you liked what you just heard on Feminist Magazine, if you liked the kind of stories we covered, please support us to keep doing that. You will be showing not just your appreciation, but you'll be putting your money where your mouth is. You'll be actually supporting more of these kind of stories. You'll be enabling us to keep these kind of voices on the air and showing us that you support these kind of stories, that you support grassroots stories, that you support stories about folks making a difference, stepping up, taking radical action. Those are the kind of stories that we bring you on Feminist Magazine every week. What we bring you is stories that are not just about quote-unquote women's issues, but radical feminist, intersectional feminist, feminism that looks at environmental issues, at climate change from a feminist point of view. This is your last chance, like I said, to support us in this hour. You go to the kpfk.org website. It's really easy. You just click the donate button, walk through a couple of steps, and there you are. And thank you.
Hello, it's Eagle and the Condor, Be a Better Relative, Lydia Ponce, and
Sun Rose Ayershel.
I'm here in Venice, California.
And I'm out here in the Great Plains of Iowa.
And together at 4 p.m. on Tuesdays, we are Be a Better Relative for the Eagle and the Condor. We're here for you to inspire and to encourage you.
And a little bit of education, a little bit of laughing.
Mm-hmm. A little bit of medicine.
All good medicine to be a better relative.
4 p.m. on Tuesdays.
Right here on 90.7 KPFK.
Support comes from the Will Gear Theatricum Botanicum, returning June 1st through October 20th with outdoor repertory theater and educational programs for all ages. The Theatricum's signature production of Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream is back alongside The Winter's Tale, Wendy's Peter Pan, a fresh take on the J.M. Barrie classic of A Boy Who Wouldn't Grow Up, Tartuffe Born Again, a new translation and adaptation of the Molière masterpiece, and the Hispanic, Latino, Latina, Latinx, Latine vote. The Wilgear Theatricum Botanicum is located in the heart of Topanga Canyon, just off the 101 freeway in the shade of the California Live Oaks. For further information and tickets, visit www.theatricum.com or go to kpfk.org.
This is Josh Radner asking.